You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is the 8th of August, 2024. And of course, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson. I debated whether to talk about this topic on my Orthodox Nationalist show or on the Daily Nationalist, but because it's largely a current event over the past few years, I've decided to do it here. And I keep meaning to bring it up, and I keep forgetting about it. There's so much going on, it's very easy to do. I want to talk about El Salvador. Only one other time, as a historical matter, in the Civil War in the 80s, have I did an entire Orthodox Nationalist on the situation there. But now, we have some very, very good news. President Nayib Bukele has been one of only a handful of chief executives that has won its war against crime, gangs, and drugs, the so-called mano dura, or the iron fist. Talk about Duterte in the Philippines, and now we can talk about Bukele in El Salvador. Both times, of course, the U.S. has vehemently and, in fact, viciously condemned him. Sanctions have been placed on him precisely because his policies have been successful in ridding the country of gangs and drugs. And it was just a few years ago that El Salvador was ruled almost entirely by criminal gangs. The nationalist government in El Salvador has destroyed these gangs, through its strict law, concerted action. But we also have to realize that the ruling classes in the U.S. and Europe support, defend, and even need violent organized crime, but only of a certain type, of course. Somehow the left sees crime, especially from the so-called lower classes, and especially from non-whites, as romantic and anti-authoritarian, like street gangs in the U.S. And of course, the gangs like MS-13 were the ones that were destroyed in El Salvador that function in the U.S. Anything else, of course, any kind of right-wing violence, like, so-called January 6th, the Italian mafia, the riots in U.K., that's a different story, of course. El Salvador had gone far beyond what even Americans know, since the gang rule over society was extraordinary. The attempts and the successful attempts to destroy them have been met with ferocious and irrational condemnation from the American government and the media, the regime. And this has been the case both in the Philippines and El Salvador, and they were condemned because they were successful. The Russians in the Syrian war destroyed ISIS there and was met immediately with condemnation from the U.S. government. And often the rhetoric is exactly the same. The crackdown began in March of 2022, one of the most concerted and powerful crackdowns on gang violence ever seen in Central America. There are two main gangs, MS-13, and there's two factions of the 18th Street or the Barrio 18 group. Nayib Bukele used to be the mayor of San Salvador, and he led this. There's been many chief executives that have tried to stamp out gang violence and gang control. I mean, El Salvador, the government didn't really control much of its territory. But previous efforts have failed. His was successful, and we have to understand why. The Salvadoran economy was nearly destroyed. It's been in trouble anyway. But the underground economy took so much over the last few decades out of the real economy that the gangs began to see themselves, and they were more powerful than the state, so long as the state had to fight with both hands behind its back. Over time, the gangs, these two in particular and their offshoots and factions, began to attack civilians, assured that nothing would happen. They created local governments, figuring that even if something did happen against them, the U.S. would step in to rescue them. Leftist element, I mean, the regime is leftist officially, but they'd rather see dead civilians and dead police any day of the week than gang members being in prison longer than they should be. Abstract human rights, so they never quite lay out in detail. They only seem to apply to these kind of people. And of course, the ruling class and their support of these gangs and their attacks on any attempt to stop them means that, of course, they share responsibility for the murders and the drug addiction that they foster. They grew in power, especially MS-13, because they came in through uncontrolled immigration into California, eventually, slowly removed from the U.S., and once back in El Salvador, used their connections in the United States to establish much larger criminal units. In the 2000s, there were numerous crackdowns, but they were uncoordinated, they were decentralized, they didn't have focus. This is where the media termed them the mano dura, or the iron fist, that was created under Francisco Perez, who left office in 2004, Antonio Saca, who left office in 2009. And ultimately, their crackdowns were just increasing the size of police forces and extending prison sentences. But that's certainly not a war against gangs, just like the American war on drugs is not a war at all. Because institutions that work in peacetime and that are meant and designed to work for fairly peaceful societies, you know, your basic due process rights, cannot be retained in the context of a civil war. Yes, you had occasional drops in violence, but they would quickly return. But it didn't matter. Once, in this case, the campaign against gangs became successful, then the Western NGOs ramped up their propaganda. Now the U.S. supports Bukele's enemies and opponents, including in the gang world. In 2012, the administration of President Mauricio Funes left office in 2014, fully admitted defeat, and he tried to broker a truce with the MS-13 and the two Barrio factions, Barrio 18. It was almost designed to fail, and it was, you know, tell your people not to hurt any more citizens, and we'll send your convicted members to non-maximum security prisons. There were some quick drops in the murder rate as a result of this, but it wore off very quickly. Why would gangs ever listen to a weak government, a government that has admitted defeat? Why would they even respect it? Gangs understand violence and violence alone. Any truce, any begging and pleading on the government's behalf just implies that gangs now have won and can do whatever they want. What really happened is that gangs began to grow in power, and then so they began to clash with each other. And 2015 was really the apogee of this. The homicide rate, at least the recorded one, was 103 per 100,000, which makes it by far the most violent country in the Western Hemisphere. Given the fact that the state didn't control much of its territory at this point, gang governments were more powerful than the government in San Salvador, you can say that the very existence of the country was at stake. So occasionally you would have, like in Seren's administration, which ended just before Bukele's in 2019, these crackdowns only had very temporary successes. San Salvador had become a failed state that couldn't control its own territory. This became the issue of issues. So Bukele was elected in the summer of 2019 with a landslide. He just won re-election in February in another ginormous landslide based entirely on this issue. The nature of this iron fist was planned control, the plan to control our territory. You know, the English translation of this, admitting that the government didn't control much of it's a small country, didn't control its own cities. Now, the plan itself was hidden from public view, since Bukele, well, it makes sense. You don't tell your enemy what you're going to do. Not to mention the U.S. would try to block it in any way it possibly could. But this was different. The gangs had their own economy. They control large areas of the country. You did see a drop, even before he was inaugurated, you did see drops in murder rates, but I think that's largely because they were a ruling class now. They were running out of enemies. But in March, mid-March of 2022, these two gangs murdered almost 90 people across the country in a span of 3 days. That massacre was one push too far. It changed everything. And that's where, March 27th of that year, the legislature, which also was under the control of Bukele's party, declared a state of emergency for a month. Bukele was so popular, he dominated, of course, both the executive, which he was, and the legislature. The executive took over entirely, as you would expect, trying to save a country being taken over by, or having been taken over by, organized crime. November of last year, the emergency measures were extended for another 2 years, and will continue to be extended. Although, as of right now, even the press will say that the gangs have been broken. In a very short period of time, the security forces arrested 80,000 people, and very quickly regained control over its own country. Western NGOs went crazy. The regime was talking about all these innocent people who have been arrested. Their human rights have been violated, which is a completely hollow phrase. This was pure special pleading. They didn't care about the drugs or the human trafficking or the extortion rackets. Of course, a crackdown like this, which really amounted to a civil war, is going to have innocent victims like any war. But that's the gang's fault, not the state's fault. You can't blame the person responding to endless and focused violence for their lashing out. But this wasn't a lashing out. The left, the NGOs, the American embassy, they were just trying to come up with anything to derail this, saying that, well, most of those arrested were only associates of the gangs. They weren't full members. Therefore, these raids were indiscriminate. They didn't care what they said. Now, the gangs had weathered many crackdowns, as I've said, since the early 2000s. But they maintained their power. No government had succeeded in breaking up their structure, their command structure, at the national level until now. They could regroup or whatever. This has changed entirely. The state of emergency and what that entails has changed everything. And it succeeded rapidly, showing how quickly a firm, centralized state with the population behind it can destroy crime, drugs, trafficking, all essentially one thing, especially in a country so small. It completely broke their command structure, their hierarchy, and they have so far been unable to mount any kind of collective response. Now, the arrestees initially, you had about 55,000 members of MS-13, who is the largest, 13,000 members of Barrio 18, one faction, and then 10,000 of the other one. That was October of 2023. And almost 1,200 men in leadership positions. Now, the gangs also have armed combat units that now, well, I should say as of about 6 months ago, these were down to 53, but in 2022, they had been over 100, mostly MS-13. These are heavily armed, combat-trained members. These are the frontline soldiers that have fought the Mexican army to a standstill, that, at least as of a few years ago, fought the Colombian army to a standstill. I've argued before that because drug empires, whether gang or individual, have helped sustain the American stock market. We know the stock market just crashed. Drug money is a huge source of liquidity because it's being laundered through these firms. Now, the state says that there were 21,000 hardcore gang members, but that's just your what we would call made guys. That figure is very low because the gang rises and falls on its associates. You know, part-time members. The U.S. condemned the crackdown violently because it worked. The murder rate fell by 50% in 2023 and continues to fall today. Violence is at an absolute record low. As of a few months ago, 91% of the citizens of El Salvador back him and back this crackdown. February of this year, 2024, he won re-election with 84% of the vote in a race contested by 13 parties. The U.S., of course, financed his opponents. The crackdown was supposed to be, it was a blitzkrieg, it was fast-moving because they needed to take these well-armed bodies by surprise. And that's why you had so many arrested. You had plenty of others going into hiding, fleeing the country, many to the USA. The gangs in the past had been able to counterattack, but that wasn't the case this time. It's amazing how the regime's language in condemning Duterte in the Philippines, 8 years ago, is identical to the condemnation against, every English language article, including from the National Review, we'll get to that in a minute, has condemned his victory over the gangs. The regime, of course, supports the mass killing of so-called Taliban members in Afghanistan, which is not a terrorist group, but the imprisonment of actual terrorists just across the U.S. border, that's a huge problem. And, of course, no one's asking this obvious question. One of the worst and most obnoxious is the International Crisis Group. This is a very wealthy, regime-centered NGO. And their paper, which came out in 2022, was called A Remedy for El Salvador's Prison Fever. And I take their point of view as the official one because their board of directors alone, they're financed by corporate America. And their arguments are awful because that's what special pleading leads otherwise intelligent people to do. One of their arguments, believe it or not, is that we all know that because they have succeeded in stamping out the gang problem, we know the U.S. is going to condemn them and place sanctions on the country because you can't do that. Therefore, it's going to harm the economy. So I guess the argument is you should just leave them alone as a result. I want to quote them here, and it's very hard to read because it's just so gross. Here's what they say. Active gang members are being rounded up alongside innocent young people and others who have left gangs, including evangelical pastors who've made it their mission to pull people out of gang life through conversion. Some arrested pastors and former gang members have been beneficiaries of a rehabilitation project run by the UN agencies and the USAID with government backing. While the men's prison population has doubled, the number of women in prison has quadrupled. Dozens of inmates have reportedly died in custody since the state of exception began. State of exception, that's the literal translation of the Spanish for the state of emergency. Now, I'm not sure what this argument is. They offer no evidence that all of these innocent people, of course you're going to have some innocent people. That's the nature of warfare. This isn't just normal criminal justice here. The gangbangers can rot in there for all I care. Their evidence is very thin. The truth is, you had a desperate government, totally losing control of its own territory, cracking down with everything it has against heavily armed gangs. Rather than that truth, they want to depict this fantasy image of the police and the military arresting people for no reason and filling jails, as if that in and of itself is a problem. They offer no evidence. As is common for groups like this, rumors, information from already committed leftist groups, that takes the place of analysis. In fact, they say because of the government's lack of transparency, their statistics are largely invented. They cite, you go through their footnotes, and they cite their own publications as authorities. They claim to have interviewed many people, and we have to take their word for it, I guess. They hate the fact that the crackdown is extremely popular with the citizens. They say, well, it's still too early to say how the havoc it has wreaked in the lives of thousands of families, and stories of inhumane prison conditions will affect the government's standing with a growing number of Salvadorans. Tough anti-gang language and tactics have been the calling cards of virtually every government over the last 2 decades, playing on the hatred and fear that the gang's brutality has instilled in Salvadorian society, as well as the failure of the 2012-2014 truce to keep violence in check for long. I guess the havoc of a full gang takeover is insufficient. It's the state's reaction that's the cause for worry. Prisons are overcrowded, of course. But what do you expect? That just means that the state has waited too long to take this kind of action. The gangs have brutalized society, not the crackdown. But the fact that these arguments are so bad, that itself, not to mention uniform over all media outlets, that's what requires an explanation. The crackdown is one thing. The fact that it's worked, that's what causes the condemnation. Because God forbid people start calling for this kind of thing in the United States. But we know what the left is. Violent crime seems to, that type of violent crime that the left likes, seems to parallel the same, is it directed against the same enemy the leftists always have? Traditional Catholic society down there. Small businesses, family, drugs, prostitution, and extortion. They keep people huddled in their homes. It destroys social bonds. What did the left do in the 2020 riots? Anybody who even tried to defend their property was arrested, not the rioters. The left lives in a fantasy world. The left seems to be aimed at their own stereotyped enemies, especially the small, white, or middle-class property owner. There's people like Charles Taylor who says that there's this vicarious dimension to why leftists support criminality, this pleasure, this rush of breaking the law, feeling empowered. The left identifies with criminals. Neil Davenport wrote in 2023, and he was quoting Hannah Arendt in her famous Origins of Totalitarianism, but he says that she argued that when elites start flirting with lumpen criminal elements in society, it shows that they have grown contemptuous of civilizational values. This captures well what is driving the left-leaning elite's endorsement of petty criminality today. They are actively disavowing the values and laws that hold our society, or in fact any society, together. And he goes on to say that it's working-class communities that have to bear the brunt of this crime, not them. They have no connection with gang criminality. This all comes from your upper bourgeoisie. Anyway, they don't have to deal with crime on a daily basis. So you have the financial connection, the billions raised by gangs that get laundered through the U.S. stock market. You have the ideological connection between crime and the left in general. And you think about it this way. If the left believes that all men are equal, all human beings are equal, and that's not as a matter of course, it's a matter of result. We see a society where people are unequal, wealth or whatever. criminals then are depicted as trying to equalize themselves with those doing better than they are, and hence their crime is legitimate and should be romanticized. Of course, these are all fantasy identifications, but it is the foundation of their love of the criminal, or a certain type of criminal. The left has the same moral code as a criminal gang anyway. In America, they're the battering ram against the white middle-class society that they despise, the Jews in particular despise. The left sees gangs in the U.S. and in El Salvador and elsewhere as allies. That's why the former Marxist militia in El Salvador, the FMLN, which is now a political party, has fought against these laws at every turn, showing and proving the connection between leftist activism and gang violence. The FMLN, the old Sandinista party in Nicaragua, have condemned these laws and this crackdown in every way it could. Of course, they're overlapping phenomena. But I want to note that the National Review, the old Buckleyite magazine, also condemns it. And they make a very stupid argument. I mentioned that years ago there was this truce with the gangs there. They claim that Bukele actually did it. Now, this hasn't been he may have been a part of this many years ago as the mayor, but not certainly since he's taken over. He says, well, the only reason that crime is going down the drain is because he has negotiated with gangs. That was the case a decade ago. That is not the case now. Mass arrests have absolutely nothing to do with it, and it's dishonest. The tactic has been tried before, as I mentioned, with very poor results. They have, of course, economic reasons for rejecting this miracle. And they'll admit that because he is aligned with Venezuela and China, as he should be, of course, that's the real reason that they hate him. So you have a country almost completely taken over by gangs and drugs with an overpowered police force. This country finally fights back, and in return, it gets nothing but pious condemnation from the U.S. Okay. The core of this victory has been the breaking of the gang's organizational structure. For the first time, this crackdown, now coming from one party controlling both branches, actually all three branches of government, went along initially in secret, then out in the open in a systematic way. There's been no regrouping. There's been no retaliation from the gangs. Gangs have mostly fled. I mean, they're cowards deep down. MS-13's top leadership ordered its members to either run to the mountains or flee entirely until, of course, the Americans forced the crackdown to be abandoned, which is unlikely. The Biden administration has suspended, I mentioned sanctions, all aid has been suspended to the national police forces in San Salvador in protest of this crackdown. All their innocent victims. The regime, through its media and the International Crisis Group and Amnesty International, they talk about the incidents about innocent people getting caught up in the crackdown, as if that's reason enough for it to be abandoned. In fact, some of the NGOs, I think the UN too, created this very maudlin group, the Victims of the Regime movement, to romanticize the gang members who have been arrested. They, of course, did nothing similar for the thousands murdered by gangs every year. Gangs are gone. They are not organized. They're either in exile, in prison, or dead. Believe it or not, some of them even might get real jobs to survive. No one denies that the victory has been won. Groups like Insight Crime, who is more moderate in their analysis, they have gone to various cities, interviewed people. Organized crime is absolutely gone, although the ICG claims that that's not true. But for the first time, residents in especially the big and medium-sized cities don't fear gang violence. They don't fear the gangs at all. So that means real social life can return for the first time in God knows how long. So as of now, you have 80,000 new prisoners overcrowding became an issue, and this is something that they glommed onto, trying to condemn everything. But to me, that's quite unimportant. The total prison population is now about 115,000 in a country with a population of just over 6 million. Now, in 2020, the total capacity of the system was about 30,000. But they just finished, I think last year, a prison with an extra 5,000 beds and a huge mega prison able to house about 50,000 inmates completed late last year. But it really doesn't matter. This is a secondary concern. All gang members know that prison is a risk, and they consent to take it. These arguments are so bad, and when I publish this, I'll put this on Patreon, and I have a bibliography of all of this there, that, you know, they try to deflect, saying that, well, there's so many new people in prison, therefore this is a horrific policy, as if that by itself is a problem. They've even revolutionized, though, over there, prison administration. Remember, physical violence is all these people understand, so they're going to get it back. You have all of these, you know, over 100,000 extremely violent prisoners and a tiny contingent of prison guards. Of course, the left then condemns all measures against them. What they've done in El Salvador is they've successfully restricted the ability of these guys to communicate with other inmates and the outside. Long-standing confinement to their cells, which of course makes sense when you have thousands and thousands of experienced gang members and a small guard. They had to do this or else they're going to be able to run their empire from prison. Even their international communications have been severed. There was always a connection in MS-13 between the gang members in the U.S. and in El Salvador. The U.S. has always been a part of the gang movement in that country. And this has been completely severed. And so without its leadership, there is no direction anymore. So you read these papers, U.S. government, all these deaths behind bars as a result of state aggression during this state of emergency. But of course, that's normal for prisons housing thousands of violent and experienced gang members. This is exclusively the fault of the gangs, not the state. These ridiculous reports and arguments come from those who hate the crackdown to begin with. These suburbanites that don't know the first thing about what it's like to live under gang violence. Of course there's going to be deaths and beatings. It's the only way to control such a population. What happens when thousands of seasoned and tough gang members are housed in one spot? This is a diseased ruling class with their fantasy image of the criminal life. And frankly, whatever happens to these guys in prison is frankly not my business. They'll kill me and you at a moment's notice. So, in more detail, the success of these policies have come down to three things. The use of a militarized police force and military units. They have refused to strictly define what gang affiliation is, and the concentration of state power in his administration. These are three things that have permitted the state of emergency to function. They have removed, under the emergency, they've removed the need for a warrant. They could arrest based on anonymous information, hold them in detention for weeks or months at a time without a hearing, which of course is normal in warfare, not in a peaceful society, of course. Finally, the security forces could do their job. They eliminated the possibility of house arrest for those arrested in members of the gangs. They lowered the age to 12 years. For which people can be tried for gang-related crimes, which makes sense. Young teens are commonly associates of gangs and used at a young age precisely to avoid prosecution. They expanded the notion of gang membership to illicit associations. And the law states that it includes anyone who promotes, helps, facilitates, or favors the activities of a criminal organization. The other word for that is a criminal. In other words, they closed every loophole that gangs and their high-powered lawyers have used in the past to get out of trouble. It's not just gang members, but their associates. And it makes sense. Of course, gangs don't have strict lines between aspiring members, members, retired members, collaborators. But a gang will rise and fall on the nature of its outer tier members. And of course, a strict definition, which is another argument that the left uses, is something that they would want because they can manipulate the meaning of words to free thousands who don't fit precisely the language of the law, which guarantees its failure. So claiming that people who are arrested under this expanded idea are innocent is normal in their argumentation. Gangs use all manner of disguise and deception to cover up their identity, and it has to be taken into consideration. But I'll repeat myself. The removal of these due process laws is normal and to be expected in a time of war. These things only operate, or could remotely operate, in times of peace in a normal society. These things are manipulated by wealthy gangs to stifle the state's attempt to end their reign over the country. Since when do enemy soldiers in wartime get a lawyer in a court hearing? This was intensely systematic. They had mapped out cities in a very specific way. And when the emergency was declared, they moved very quickly. These guys at the local level knew precisely what was going on and where they functioned. But given due process laws in the past, they couldn't act. This mapping, which had been going on for some time from the authorities, meant that they could very quickly make arrests immediately. This is a tactic that's an absolute necessity. They kept it a secret at the federal level because they knew that, of course, if the gangs knew what was going on, they would take measures, and the U.S. government and the NGOs and the left and media would be informing gangs as to what's going to happen. This is an absolute necessity if the country wants to survive. But the Legislative Assembly, under the party of New Ideas, which is Bukele's party, in late 2021, fired hundreds of judges. Now, the courts would have no role in the conduct of an army during a war, so I don't see why they would in this case. Thousands of lives are at stake. And anybody siding with a terrorist, which, by the way, a gang member is inherently a terrorist in the emergency legislation, should be removed anyway. So let me summarize what the state of emergency has included. Arrest with no warrant. It increases the time that a detainee can be held without a hearing. There's no guarantee of a defense lawyer. Government can intercept civilian communications. They can set up roadblocks and checkpoints. Increased prison sentences. Again, the lowering of the age to 12. Rapid arrests. Emergency measures allow for collaborators to be held without formal charges. Ambiguously define collaborator as gang members and hence terrorists. And can move against really whoever they want. And these are all justified since the crackdown would fail otherwise. Legal guarantees are weapons that the gangs could use and have used to clog the judicial system. The absence of the MS-13 and Barrio 18 in neighborhoods that used to be directly controlled by the gangs is history. Especially in urban areas, but also in rural areas. And they relied on their extensive network of low-level members and collaborators, lookouts, informants, etc., not just to prevent arrest, but to enforce their own rules because they controlled these areas. They settled disputes, not the state. And as we all know, in Europe and the U.S., there's no-go zones. Police usually didn't enter territories that these gangs ruled. That's now history. Insight Crime, I mentioned them already, and I got the idea from them. Interviewed many people in former gang strongholds. And the people, it's very clear that the gang structures don't exist there anymore. The residents were talking about being under constant surveillance from gangs and how they're to live. There was no freedom of movement under gang control. There was no economy under gang control that they didn't dominate. They had their own checkpoints. Now, you have new community projects. You have the resurrection of civil society in the true sense of the word for the first time in years. Sports has returned. Local level soccer tournaments for the first time in God knows how long, because the gang restrictions on movement have been removed. The truth is, only a harsh war, a war against these gangs who are an army in a civil war, could ever do anything like this. That's why it's failed in the past. Even those guys who have been released from jail have nothing to go back to. Black markets have disappeared. Today, the state controls all of its territory for the first time in decades. It's absolutely extraordinary. Drugs have largely, of course, they're never going to be gone completely, but dealers have evaporated. There's no organization. I also want to note that gun laws in El Salvador over the last few decades have been pretty much like the American version. You have a 5-day waiting period. All weapons must be registered. Concealed carry is permitted. You can't have a criminal record, stuff like that. It's pretty close to that. But you're seeing victory and the resurrection of the economy and the society as a whole. Bukele's victory against the gangs has altered the country's landscape. Homicide rates, crime is at absolute historic lows. You had whole communities, whole regions, now finally able to come out of their home. Extortion is gone. Prostitution is gone, at least in an organized way. And of course, now that he's been reelected for a second term, he has his whole economic agenda. He has a 6-phase economic plan. He wants to rebuild farmers markets. And then, you know, larger state-controlled food distribution centers. It's very odd. El Salvador, being agrarian, imports most of its food. The role of the gangs in controlling food distribution is another matter. And so he's lowered tariffs on 116 products in the state's essential food basket for a decade, making it as cheap as humanly possible. I mean, he inherited a terrible economy, massive debt, and because of the gangs, had very low foreign direct investment. Their textile industry, which is their dominant one, faced a lot of competition from Asia. The gangs were a huge economic burden. Extortion alone took 3% of the GDP away. That's just one measure. But becoming a part of BRICS, SCO, is absolutely essential, and renegotiate its debt, maybe not with the West, but with BRICS. The gangs have been broken. It can be done. But it has to be a war. Due process doesn't exist in wartime. Now, once peace is achieved, that's a separate matter. But if they ever come back, understand that they'll do it again. Their tight control over prison movement and communications is essential to this as well. They set up all kinds of anonymous hotlines to tip off the cops. Talk about democratic. He's going to set up permanent neighborhood watch programs. This is the fault of gangs, not the state. I mean, gang leaders had relationships with previous governments. This is the first time that that's failed. There's so much money in gangs and drugs that they're able to buy whatever they want. Bukele is the first man to say this isn't going to happen. But you have neoconservative groups as well as leftist groups condemning him for various reasons. The economic model, the power of the state, has been an extraordinary victory. And it's not front page news. In fact, never was front page news. And now you have leaders all over, not just Central America, but South America, trying to imitate him. You have something similar going on in Honduras, at least last year. Even the U.S. media says the crime problem has been solved, the drug problem has been solved. And that's exactly why it's condemned, which opens up the issue as to what's the connection between the regime and organized crime and gangs, which has a lot to do with open borders. And what's the left's connection with gang violence directly and indirectly? But the benefits of the gangs being destroyed, it's only just begun to show itself. The country's being reborn. The economy is being reborn. Fear is disappearing. Confidence has increased. These guys get kicked and have stuff thrown at them as they come down the street where they used to be able to rule over these areas. But when you read the regime's condemnation of these policies, it's almost hilarious how terribly abusive it is. It's all innocent people who are being arrested for no reason. I'd love to see these guys be a prison guard, having to keep these men in line. The term that the left is using now is autocrat. He's an autocrat. He's a dictator. Which is just projection, of course. So now they're reduced to name calling. Simply put, you don't have due process in a civil war. There's nothing extraordinary about this. Gangs declared war on society, both in the U.S. and El Salvador and elsewhere. And for the first time, they've gotten it declared right back at them. Civil procedure is good for a healthy, virtuous society. It cannot exist in wartime. The country was not at peace. Although now it very well may be. Violations of due process don't make, you know, that's not even a sensible thing to say in wartime. The lives that have already been saved are extraordinary. Of course, the gangs can never entirely go away. So long as there's crime, there's going to be gangs, an organization. Crime is always going to be a problem. So long as human passion and irrationality exists, you're going to have this kind of thing. But the organization and dominance is long gone. Now the economic rebuilding can begin, and maybe Americans are going to start asking, why can't this be done here? And there'll be a host of reasons. Racism will be one reason why we can't come down hard, because gangs in America are almost exclusively non-white. Anyway, this is good news for once. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.